welcome to the Vibrational Voyage radio program. Vibrational Voyage is about exploring the evolution of consciousness and the dynamics of global transformation. My name is Tony McGettigan, and I'll be your host for this journey.
I have great pleasure to talk with an author and bring you an interview with her. Her name's Rebecca A. Field, PhD. Rebecca Field is a very international person. She's thrilled to awaken to emails from Russia, Japan, Australia, the Middle East, and Africa. She did teacher training in Colorado, and the first year out of the university, she taught middle school in Anchorage, Alaska. A frugal saver, she managed to travel alone around the world for a year. When she returned to the States, she married Ken Field and put him through graduate school at the University of Chicago. Both their sons were born in Chicago. Her husband was later employed by IBM. Once settled in Silicon Valley, Rebecca found the California Institute of Integral Studies and commuted for 11 years, finally earning a master's degree in Asian philosophy and a doctorate in East-West psychology. Rebecca worked in the psychology field for a few years and started an international nonprofit organization that was active with Tibetan refugees and marginalized Russian women. Her work in Russia and Ukraine dealt with combating human trafficking and sex slavery. Rebecca and her husband adopted a Tibetan refugee who came from India and lived with them while she earned her BSN and RN. Tibetan Tashi now lives near San Francisco and serves as a nurse in a big hospital outside the city. And in addition to this, Rebecca has done quite a lot of work around the world, like in Russia and the former Soviet Union, and then quite a lot of volunteer work. So we're going to hear about some of those experiences and some of Rebecca's own insights. And the book is called To Choose the Fire of the Cosmos. And it has a wonderful foreword by the Dalai Lama. The book deals with the transformation of human experience and consciousness and the transformation of society. So wonderful to talk with you, Rebecca. We've known each other for years, and I didn't realize you were working on this book. So it was a real pleasant surprise when I saw that, and even more of a pleasant surprise when I actually started to read it just in the last few days. Welcome, and thank you for taking the time to have a chat about this.
Oh, Tony, it's my pleasure. It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Evolutionary cosmology is one of the big themes in the book. Tell us a little bit about what that is.
I spent most of my life wondering what I should do when I grow up. It was just a question that plagued me, and I never could find the answer until I was 72, and I came across some of the writings of Brian Swim. He's a mathematical cosmologist, and I got the idea from Brian Swim. But at 72, I didn't want to start out on another graduate degree, thank you. And so I turned it around in my mind for a few days, and by George, I came up with evolutionary cosmologist, and I knew it fit. It finally fit. Something finally fit. And just that alone, after a lifetime that long of searching, was a relief, and it was a...
So it sounds like something clicked. It was an epiphany of sorts. There was something about his insight that really triggered something in you. What was it? Was there any particular thing?
I can't remember. Yeah. But he speaks of oneness and kind of a, well, what I call a trans-Himalayan outlook. It's nicely salted and peppered with Eastern philosophy and the West too, Western philosophy. So that's really how it happened.
Well, and you studied. I mean, you have a background in it, and so a deep appreciation for this. And we were just reading in your bio that you've done work with Tibetans and adopted a Tibetan. Yes. So you have an appreciation of Eastern philosophy from a as a student and as a from a scholarly point of view, you've got a PhD in East-West psychology, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those concepts are something that are near and dear to you. These are things that you've studied. But then you've also gone there, known the people, worked with them, and tried to make some contributions that would actually help along the way.
Yes.
Maybe talk a little bit about some of your work. And how did you get started in that work? What was it that drew you into doing this work?
Search for what I was here for.
Mm.
A purpose.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't find it, and I didn't realize. Tony, I felt like I was caught forever on the inside of a big Christmas tree ball. With no way out, I couldn't reach the top to get out, and it was just slick inside and round, and I was just plain stuck in this career area. Oh, I was just...
What was, in those days, when you felt stuck, what was it you were doing?
Going to school, trying to get unstuck, mainly.
Yeah?
Yeah, I just, you know, I didn't have any confidence in myself at all.
Hmm.
And so I just kept going to school because I didn't know what else to do. And my boys were growing up, and I still wanted to be home. Something in me always wanted to be home to do what the family needed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I looked for all kinds of things to do. I can remember once I visited a bra factory for extra large ladies in Scotts Valley with the idea that, oh, maybe this was what God wanted me to do. And fortunately, I didn't get that because... That's not, you know, sewing is just about the last thing.
So you would have actually, if you would have done that, you would have worked on the factory floor?
No, I would have bought the operation and tried to run it without any business experience whatsoever.
I see.
And, you know, it was really a kick. But, you know, at that time, I let the din of the society come in.
Hmm.
And... it sounded like, well, if you're worth anything, you will go out and run General Motors.
Oh, yes. So this was kind of like, it seemed like maybe that was a path to follow because it was a kind of the culture or people that you looked up to or respected kind of suggested, oh, this is a way to achieve your dreams or to fulfill your purpose.
Yeah, and my husband, who was... he worked with several big electronic companies. He told me you would just hate it.
Oh, because he worked for big companies and knew the nature of business.
And knowing that I just really like to fly. And he said you'd just hate it. And I think I probably would, but... there is still that little piece inside that wonders.
Well, but then you did ultimately start to do some very interesting work with organizations, and I want to hear more about that. But did that evolve out of your finding the educational niche that really worked for you, like the East-West psychology training and so forth? What was it? What was the sequence of events like? Did you finally find the niche educationally, academically, and then it led you to some of this service work?
I'd have to start at the age of 9, if that's okay. When I came home from school one day, I think it was in May, because I remember beautiful spring afternoon, and I came home and my mother had been reading out of a book entitled A Treatise on White Magic. She said, "Would you sit down for just a minute? I've been reading this, and I just want to share a little bit with you." So I thought, I want to be outside with the flowers and the blue sky and the earth. But I thought I better do it. Anyway, she read probably no longer than 15 minutes to me. I was in about the fourth grade. And I had no idea what she was reading. And I read the same book today, and it's very advanced. And But it's not so advanced that it's impossible.
So there were seeds.
There were seeds planted
for this early.
On, very early. And by the time I was out of high school, the hunger for it became very deep. And I got to college. I found myself studying in the corner where the books on the Far East and Eastern religion or philosophy happened to be. I was just, that's the one place in the library that was most comfortable. It was warm and inviting to me. And so those are little things that were along the way. And
so you had these approximations. I mean, things were drawing you toward this, it seems now, as you look back.
Oh, yeah.
You can see this from the time you're in fourth grade.
Yes.
There were things that were catching your attention and, you know, and you're living your life, you're being adventurous, but you're taking care of your family and so forth. And gradually what's happening is something is really flowering and developing in you. And then you have this epiphany when you're 72. And then it sounds like that's really when things started to go.
It is in a way, but it was a very calm and quiet epiphany. I hardly even knew it.
Uh-huh.
But I know finally, 6 or 8 years later, that I'm doing what I came here to do.
All right, well, let's go back to that. So what is the meaning of this evolutionary cosmology?
Well, in my study of metaphysics, I was always taken the word evolution or evolutionary transformation and felt so right. It felt so fitting, and it was something that made me wildly excited, and that in itself is a clue that you're on the right track. So I thought, well, okay. Brian Swim was a mathematical cosmologist. I don't quite want to follow that path, but I'll be an evolutionary cosmologist.
And jump ahead too far, but this, there's a vision that goes with this about what's going on with us right now. Your love of evolutionary cosmology, and it's directly tied to what's going on right now with humanity, with humanity's experience.
Yes.
Tell us, you know, what is it that you see that's going on here from your perspective? What is this process that we're going on here? Tell us from your point of view and your experience, what is it? What is this?
With humanity right now?
Yeah.
Well, we're all being touched by whatever this is that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And we're touched in many different ways, many different levels of our being. And speaking of levels, there are many levels of reality.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and certainly the human being contains a lot of these levels. We've taken a path toward the materialistic, I think, Tony. It's not been tempered with its opposite, which is the sacred. You know, if somebody speaks of the sacred, it's like, it's very odd. It almost is like an irritant, at least in my experience.
And so there's something that's, from your experience, from your perspective, it's extremely relevant, the sacred. And and then how we can begin, or how the process of transformation goes with an appreciation of the sacred.
Yes.
Maybe you'd kind of talk about that.
Well, you know, it's all around us everywhere, and we don't know it because it doesn't have it written on the back of a chair or on the carpet or the wall. It's just, but it, there it is. It's written on your face. It's written on the picture of a person from Afghanistan. There is no place, literally, where you can't find it if you look.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a heap of learning for me because, especially as a young person, I let the din of the society come in. And it was a mistake, but I didn't know what else to do.
Well, what became the turning point for you where you realized that that noise was something that was taking you away from that sense of the sacred? And how was it that, were there particular events or experiences that were punctuation points or milestones in turning your attention away from that noise?
I'll tell you, one of the loveliest experiences I ever had in my life was about 3 or 4 years ago. And I walked from my house to a nearby shopping center to meet a friend for coffee. And I turned down a particular street, and I saw limping toward me an old man. And this old man, I could see at a distance, had a white beard. And it was the longest white beard I had ever seen on any human man, any place on the planet. And I've been in a lot of places. And he had absolutely white hair and this long, long, long white beard. And as he got closer, I could see he was an African American. And I like African Americans a lot. Got a lot of African American friends. And so I caught his eye as we walked toward each other. And when I knew I had his eye, I smiled at him. And we both kept walking toward each other. And he was wearing a navy blue stocking cap with grass on it. I mean, he was obviously very poor. And a navy pea jacket and blue jeans, and his boots. His boots were so memorable because they had absolutely round red, orange, yellow, green, and blue spots of different sizes, perfectly round. And the colors were just as clear as if they'd come out of a paint tube. And he kept walking toward me, and when he got right next to me, he stopped, and I thought, what's going on here? And he stopped and he looked me in the eye and he said, "It is joy that wakes us up every morning." Well, it really took me aback. I felt so enormously privileged to have heard this. I felt like I had been picked out of 7 billion souls on this earth to hear that. I finally had the presence of mind to say, "And may joy be with you all the rest of every day." And he said, "Yes." And then he went on.
Yeah.
And it was really an experience like being picked out of the sky almost and had this exquisite piece of wisdom given to me for no apparent reason.
Yeah.
And I regret one thing about that experience, and that is that I was so shaken by it or so taken aback by it that I failed to turn around and see if he had continued walking or if he had disappeared. So he was 100% human, and he was 100% something else.
Well, and that's also what you kind of talk about. It comes out early in your book. It's something that seems to be another theme that goes all through it. This is cosmic fire, right?
There you go.
And so I imagine that that moment, that experience, was a moment of being touched by that fire.
Yeah, it was. It was absolutely. And when I finally met my friend, it just poured out of me what had happened. And I know it didn't touch her at all. But I was just stunned. In the most exquisite way to have heard this man say this. And I remember his face so well. It was long and slender. His skin was beautiful and very, very smooth. As I say, 100% human and 100% something beyond human. really lovely.
Well, and I would imagine now that you have, because you mentioned earlier that it's something that you can find everywhere in every face.
Yes.
When you're available to it, when you're seeing it, when you have eyes to see it.
Yeah.
So I'm imagining that you've seen this because you've had the great good fortune and the good-heartedness to go around and try to make a contribution to help make some positive difference. It's really compelling. Some of the things you tried to do are some of the most challenging, the most difficult things to work with women who are oppressed, and then sex slavery. So those areas, I mean, I'm imagining that some of the things that you've seen that light, you've seen that fire present in all sorts of places, in all sorts of experiences.
I am so convinced that the sacred is everywhere that I go into a foreign country. It's easier for some reason to do it in a foreign country than it is here.
Hmm.
And it's here just as well as it is in Russia or Costa Rica or wherever. But I immediately search for the stuff that's holy. And it's there. It may be in a church and it may not be in a church. It may be in somebody's eyes or marching soldiers even.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember in Moscow at the, what do we call, what's the...
The Kremlin?
Yes.
So how did you find yourself doing work in Russia and the former Soviet Union? How did that all happen?
Well, of course, I was still seeking a career and wondering what I was supposed to do. What was my purpose here? I couldn't, and it really bothered me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to be with my adopted Russian daughter at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And she happened to have her mother, who was from Kiev in Ukraine, with her, and they were speaking in Russian.
Huh.
And a woman walked up to them and spoke to them in Russian, and they introduced me in English, fortunately. And this lady was from Saratov, Russia.
Oh.
And we are, to this day, we are the best of friends. Let me tell you, if ever you're in trouble, you need to know this lady, because she knows just what to do in Russia anyway,
mm-hmm.
to get you out of trouble. Mm-hmm. And terribly responsible, highly intelligent, thoughtful, caring person, and politically astute. And I'm just not at all that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, politics just kind of comes in one ear and goes out the other, but
it's good to have friends that have that antenna.
I should say she was the advisor to the governor of that particular area in Russia. So that says something, that she was well enough thought of by the governor to seek her advice upon occasion.
And was there a particular interesting synergy that happened because of your friendship with her?
Well, I think I didn't realize it at first, because I was so eager to get the show on the road and try to find out what it was I was supposed to be doing. I can't tell you what pain it caused me. I just did everything I could, turned every rock I could find upside down to try to find the answer to this, and I couldn't. So I was very eager to work with her, and she was at that time in charge of a small Russian nonprofit organization, and they were doing business training for poor women in Russian style, you know. Well, I asked her, do you teach them how to keep the books and do accounting? Oh, yes, Russian style, of course, which is fine. It wasn't anything that turned my wagon wheels too much to write numbers in rows, but it has to be done. It's part of the business world. Part of what they were doing also was teaching young people how to avoid sex slavery. And basically what I did was to raise money here and send it over to them in Saratov. I can tell you a very touching story of a little girl who got caught in it. And she went to a shoe store with her mother one late morning, as I understand the story. And her mother was buying shoes for herself and had found something and was getting checked out. And a man came along and saw the little girl and talked to her, and he was very nicely dressed and had a kind face. And he said, "Well, if your birthday is next week, what would you like for your birthday?" She said, "Oh, I would love a Barbie doll." And he said, "Well, you know, I'll bet we could go and find you a Barbie doll. Let's see if your mother will let you go." So he went up to the little girl's mother and asked her. He said, "I'll be back in 10 minutes. There's a Barbie doll store near here. I know right where it is. I'm going to get her a Barbie doll, and I'll bring her back to you." It was the last the mother ever saw of her daughter.
My.
So 12 years old, she probably went to who knows where. But they get kids excited about, you see, the Russians under communism were so poor, there is just this hankering kind of to have material goods. They know that they're available in North America, and they want a piece of life too. And Tony, they get these kids, and they get boys too. Boys are not free from this at all. So we went around, the Russians who live in Saratov, went around to institutions, schools, whatnot, all over that region and told boys and girls what this was about. You go in and they'll tell you, well, you can get a fancy high-paying job in Dubrovnik. It's a beautiful city and you'll love it there.
They're trying to entice them with these stories, right?
Stories and money. And the kids fall for it. And once they go, they're gone for good. And most of them are dead by the time they're 30. It's because of the disease is transmitted. So, just awful.
And so you managed to make relationships and friends and find things that you could do to collaborate and synergize and support worthwhile efforts that were going on there. And as you say, you were looking for something that was really your path, your purpose, the fulfillment of your purpose. So tell us more about how it was that you ultimately found that. And that, you know, I know that must relate to the insights that are in your book.
Well, in my metaphysical studies, Tony, I have been led to try to understand the nature of the soul and its tremendous importance in human life. So I wasn't aware of it at the time because the noise, the social noise, was so loud that I couldn't hear it. But I can look back now and see I was doing exactly what I was supposed to do at that time.
Yeah.
And it was just a stepping stone to what I'm doing now. And we don't see these things.
I follow you because I know exactly what you mean. It's very strange and mysterious and confounding.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's places in your life where you don't see very far, or it's hard to understand how it makes any sense to be going through what we go through. And later it does make sense. You see how the pieces fit together. Yeah, it's very interesting because, you know, I was raised Catholic, and you too, right?
Yes, raised
Catholic. So there's a lot of concepts. Something like the soul, the word soul, is a heavily laden word. Well, I'll just give this little description, and these are some of the things that are kind of laid on that idea. You have it and you can lose it, or, you know, you got to take care of it or you got to save it. And it's all of these crazy ideas, and it's been used mostly to scare people and to alienate them from their own nature. Mm-hmm. But the the reality of whatever that word points to is something that we can recognize for ourselves. We can have our own experience of what this is, especially when you start to put yourself at some distance from all of those ideas about what this thing is and start to have your own sense of what your own inner life and the essence of your own life. And to me, it's found in how all of your experiences are tied together, which is what you're saying right now. Because I think one way we could look at it is that there's this living thing inside us, and you think of it like a big, beautiful plant. And has all these branches and flowers that go in every direction. And those are all our experiences. Yes. And then when we see the plant and all the branches and flowers and see how they all go together, which is exactly what you're saying, then the reality of it starts to actually make itself known to us. And then it's no longer a belief with all these crazy ideas. It's something that we know directly through our own living and breathing and knowing.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about that too. I mean, the meaning of that and what the value of that is from your perspective.
The meaning and the value is priceless. It means everything, you know, because it explains everything. I think it connects us, because the soul is just a part of this oneness that we are all part of. You know, we're a part of each other in a certain sense. Mm-hmm. And just as much as we're part of the stardust,
mm-hmm.
and at a different level.
Mm-hmm.
And I find the beauty of it just extraordinary. And it's a compelling beauty that just never leaves. It, as this dear black man said, mm-hmm. it is joy that wakes us up every morning. It's, you know, there's hope in it, there's positive energy, there's goodwill and love and what we call truth, beauty, and goodness. I think those were the Platonic three that were so important.
And how would you relate them to the soul, this notion of soul?
Well, I think they explain it as much as you can get human words to explain it.
Yeah, say more about that.
What I want to say first of all here is that in Buddhism, for instance, they don't believe in a soul. But, and I talked this over with my Tibetan daughter, and she kind of balks over it because official Buddhism doesn't really admit to a soul. And yet, I've read descriptions exactly. I mean, if they had come out of a Christian book, it would have been just, I think, almost letter for letter, word for word,
right.
Exactly the same thing.
Right. I've heard Robert Thurman.
Uh-huh.
He was introducing a presentation by the Dalai Lama on the Four Noble Truths. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, he was kind of making a commentary on what the Dalai Lama was speaking about, related to the Four Noble Truths. And he said, he clarified that, and he said that Buddhism denies the existence of an absolute soul, something that exists as an entity unto itself, separate from everything. But he says it doesn't at all deny, it actually celebrates what he referred to as the relative soul. And the way that I take that, not to try to overinterpret what he's saying, is that the life of our being, our inner life, is something that we have in common with everyone, as you were saying, and that is the deeper truth that's so connected throughout all experience. It's connected through all of our places that we go as a single being, what we refer to as a person, but then it's also connecting all existence and all experience together. So I took something very rich from that little commentary that Robert Thurman gave. And it gave me an insight. So a lot of times there are these qualifications on concepts, and the problem is the concepts. The deeper reality, if the concepts are used well, they point us to something that's deeper. And I'm one that I kind of lean in many ways towards a Buddhist point of view, in that I recognize the value of getting away from our ideas, because our ideas are so constrictive to the experience. And so what I've found that works so well, it's probably very resonant with your own practice. When we find ways to listen to our experience and give our attention to what's going on aside from what we think about it, when we give our attention to what's actually going on, as one of my heroes and authors that I really look up to on this subject, a guy named Terence McKenna. And he said that what's really important here, and to me this is an essential Buddhist idea, an essential Christian idea as well, what's most important is the felt sense of immediate experience. And that's soul. That's what the heart is really all about. And so we start to get into what our felt experience is actually all about. That's our heart and soul. Well, that exactly is something that we can touch immediately. It's a self-evident reality. And it takes us immediately beyond the realm of all of our ideas about what our existence is. So to me, that's really a beautiful enabling experience or an enabling focus. So through that kind of focus, we get our own direct experience. We get our own direct intuitive realization of what this is.
My life has been dotted with these experiences of universality. I'm so fortunate because it happened when I was quite young, and it appeared at first like it was very mystical stuff, and it probably was because of my immaturity, but these things keep happening. And I can remember I opened the Christian Science Monitor, and there was a picture of a Polish worker, and I thought, my brother.
You had this realization immediately.
Yeah.
Just a direct intuitive insight. Just
yeah.
Boom.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a brotherhood brother, not any particular relation, but just the relation being more cosmic, if you will.
Yeah.
And
it was sudden.
Oh, it was totally sudden. Yeah. And I've had that repeat itself many times when I see pictures in books or newspapers or publications.
Yeah.
Even in the flesh, I see people and I think,
wow. One of the things that's so striking to me about your interest in this subject and that you're writing about it so with such a practical focus on, you know, how we can actually do things that facilitate our movement, our positive movement in this evolution. What is so beautiful and powerful to me is that this experience that you're having and articulating, it is another example of how this is happening everywhere.
Yes.
Currently, this is something that is happening everywhere that we look in the world. If we have, like you said, if we have the eyes to see it, if we will recognize it, it's going on everywhere. And when I hear you talk about this, and I get the sense of your own intuitive experience with this, it resonates with my own. And I turn around and I look for other people who can also, you know, speak to the reality of this. And there are people everywhere. They're talking about things that are so profound. And these are experiences that are so deep. I mean, they move you to tears. They transform your existence when you have these experiences. And they take you to places that are beyond description. These kinds of experiences are becoming more and more prevalent. And at the heart of all these experiences is the knowledge that this has to do with a natural growth process, and that these experiences are a manifestation of a natural growth, an evolution process. So I would love to hear your feelings about that too, that this is something that is happening all over the place. And there's, you know, your experience and your writing is evidence of it, and you probably recognize this also with other people who have similar insights and experiences.
Yes, I think, Tony, what I find is that people, not only myself, but I find others who find themselves purposeless, and they're looking, searching deeply, and they don't know what it is that they're after. And you know, here you are working in the electronics industry,
mm-hmm.
And of course, living here, that's a fairly obvious thing to do.
But, yeah, right.
But what about a 100-year-old woman who gets a job putting needles from a needle factory in little packages so they can be sold? And she just loves this work, and she, her eyes are still good enough that she can do that.
This is someone you know personally?
No. She was written about in the Christian Science Monitor
a
few months ago. And, of course, I don't know her state of consciousness at all, but...
She's got some purpose, and she's happy.
Absolutely. Just thrilled. She's, you know, at 100 to be able to be employed. You know, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
I suppose, you know, I know people who are indigo children, for instance, and they seem to get this at least 50 years or more before I really began to understand it. You know, it's almost like the stuff is rolling in so fast that...
Now you're in the way you feel it?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me if this is something that also you would relate to, that when you get to this place where you're so at home with this experience, it's like the time doesn't matter. Yeah, it may have taken decades to get there, or even 72 years. You know? But it's like whatever time it takes is the time it takes. And being in that state is something that is so important and valuable. You love and appreciate it just to have the awareness, the experience of being in that state.
Yeah. It's almost like turning on the radio. It's there all the time. And all you have to do is just be aware of it. It's so utterly simple and so beautiful. And I fell over myself for decades, and it was unnecessary, but I didn't know what else to do. You know, I thought you had to push a boulder up a mountain, I think, and struggle over this, make it hard. And
what is it now in the place where you're at and the state of your own existence now? What is the imperative or the insight that comes to you now? Because you're contrasting that with having to push and struggle so hard before.
Yeah.
How do you find it now?
Well, I find it now a thing of just simply opening the eyes and seeing it. It's so simple. May I tell you something?
Yeah, I'd love to. Yes, please.
For instance, Tony, 6 months ago, no, 9 months ago, I did not know that there was such a thing as mass incarceration. Do you know about it?
Well, go ahead and tell me more.
Well, I've talked to a number of people. They have no idea what it is. Well, that means a mass of people are in jail. Well, that's as close as they can come. They have no idea about the horrors of it. And it's the incarceration of African Americans and people of color.
In particular, the way it's practiced here, the way law enforcement is practiced here,
yes,
very selectively, and we have a lot of minorities, especially African American people in prison.
Yeah.
Is that connected with what you're referring to?
Definitely. And I have a number of African American friends, very fine people. I find that the African Americans I've known have a spiritual quality. They would understand this. I think they would accept it. It's just part of their being. The rest of the society has gotten so intellectual, kind of mentally separative, that they miss it. And so suddenly, let me tell you what happened. I got an email from a group, and it was about intending, how important intending peace in the world was, and sustainability for the environment, and all of this kind of thing. The list is infinite, let's face it. And they have just a kind of an affirmation that's four sentences long, maybe. I've not counted, but it's not very long. And suddenly I thought, you do this for African Americans, for the problem of mass incarceration, and use intention and visualization and imagination, because those are the elements that the mind can use to create freedom. So I'm embarking upon, this one is a little bit challenging, or could be. It hasn't been challenging at all. And the African Americans I'm working with are just dear about it. They're just so sweet and want to cooperate and help and do anything they can. Because they know the heartbreak and the tragedy that comes out of this. The reason I bring it up is because it was like, bang, here's an idea. Are you going to do something about it, or are you going to let it go? Well, I'm trying to get a website up just as fast as I can to get a million signatures to say, hey, this isn't right. We'll turn it over to the President, the Congress, and the Supreme Court, and the UN High Commission on Human Rights.
This is something, another example of the way that you're actually trying to take an insight and a realization, something that hits you suddenly and moves you, and try to put it into action. I'm kind of seeing a pattern in the way that your insights and your realizations come to you, and then it moves you into some action. Is that
exactly,
kind of
exactly,
part of the story of you know, what your experience has been and what you're writing about?
I'll tell you, a person once gave me a birthday card, Tony, and it was a bunch of people having a tea party, but they were walking 2 feet over the floor. And I have been accused of hovering over the floor a lot because of my ruminations on the infinite and eternal. And I can't seem to stop it. It just is a part of the way I am. But It's very rich, so I wouldn't want to give it up.
But you've also observed how the use of your attention and your energy along these lines, it makes an impact.
Yes, and it seems to be expanding and accelerating, which is real.
Say more about that.
Well, I mean, just...
More very recently.
Yeah.
Please, I'd love to hear about that.
Well, this idea just came a month ago.
Okay.
And here I am trying to write books and blogs and all this kind of thing just as fast as I can. And now I've got to do this. And then before that, a month or two before that, the United Nations came in, and I had an opportunity to volunteer to be on this committee that's working on the Global Commons. And...
With the United Nations? You actually work with the United Nations?
Well, yes, we do. It's a group that meets by conference call, and it's international. We've got a bunch of international people who come.
And when you say you're working on the commons, what is it that that actually refers to? What are you working
well,
on?
Well, rivers, for instance, and forests, and those are the main things I've heard so far.
So the things, the wealth of the earth that we all share and own in common.
Yes, exactly. And it seems that the commons is a term that came up in somebody's conversation that gives people who are working with the United Nations a way to talk about it and give a reference point that everybody will understand. Because if we just talk about rivers, we're going to get stuck. But if we talk about commons, it's like raising it another level.
Okay.
And it becomes almost more understandable.
Well, and then I would imagine it's all the living resources. It would be the air. It would be
absolutely
everything that we have in common and share. And what makes the planet such a viable living resource for us. And That's very interesting as well. And you say that's something that's developed recently where you've become involved?
Yeah, just since, I think, July, not very long ago. I think I've attended 3 meetings so far. So, I'm just really getting my feet wet.
Well, what are some of the things that you feel are most practical implications of what it is that you're writing about? What are the things that you would point to as some of the most important lessons and things that we can do?
Well, in my research in the last 6 or 8 months for a book I had just finished, it's in man's, why is man here? Why is man the way he, she is? Why are we this way?
Mm-hmm.
Why can we love so much? And why can we think and imagine and be inclusive in our thinking? Well, the answer seems to be because it's in our charge to take care of the lower kingdoms with love and respect and treat them with beauty and honor.
Like, kind of like being a guardian, sounds like.
Yes, yes. And help them, you know, in a certain sense, I think it's like taking the Bodhisattva vow. You help all of these until the last one finally goes home. And then after that, you can go yourself. But it's such a lovely idea. And I'm quite an animal rights activist, and certainly animals obviously need to be treated with. There's something sentient in them, and we need to treat them well, I think. There's an immense intelligence in the plant kingdom, just we don't have any idea. And look at the mineral kingdom and the beauty of the crystals they form. Now, from my perspective, that's a certain kind of intelligence that does that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think, probably, a mineral likes to be used as a bomb. They don't want to destroy, probably. Because life is made for life, to live. It's made to be beautiful. And it is so, so very beautiful and holy.
That's a very wonderful observation. Your book that we have, we're going to let everybody know. It's available right now. To Choose the Fire of the Cosmos by Rebecca A. Field, PhD. It's a marvelous book. This one came out last year, right?
Just about a year ago right now.
And that's marvelous. And you say you have another one that you're working on right now that's soon to be out.
Yes, it'll be an e-book. It won't look quite like that.
What's the title of the one that's coming?
It's a handbook on the Great Invocation.
Ah.
Which is one of the great prayers but it's a prayer of East and West together. And it's very short. It's easily memorized.
Do you have it committed to memory?
Uh-huh.
Would you mind
sharing
that?
I'd be happy to.
I'd love to hear it.
From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth.
That is lovely. Rebecca, thank you so much for sharing your insights, your experience, your writing, and for being a guest for this interview. Thank you so much.
Oh, Tony, thank you.